the essence of science is logic, careful collection of data, unwillingness to reach conclusions until you've studied as much evidence as is available. And to check all along the way on the data, what it means, etc. And unfortunately, the scientific community in general has not been scientific in its approach to flying saucers. If you look at the stuff put out by the nasty, noisy negativists, they never reference the large-scale scientific studies. They talk about interstellar travel. They never reference the studies about that. They don't know anything about nuclear propulsion. Ignorance is bliss, I guess. And people are a little surprised that I am not on the pro-SETI side. And as I said earlier, you know, SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, S-E-T-I. Aren't we after the same thing? No, we're not. I'm after truth. They want to keep their programs going. If alien visitors are coming here, who needs to listen with radio telescopes? Learn sign language might be more productive. So I'm indicting them because I've been following their work. They don't follow mine. You won't find references to the major UFO scientific studies in the work of the SETI people or the astronomical community. And they also are under the strange impression that the only place science gets done is at universities. I hate to disabuse that notion, but, you know, if you want a stealth aircraft, you go to Lockheed. You don't go to some university. I've had two different scientists tell me, Stan, if Roswell had happened, they'd have had to pull the physicists from half the colleges in the country. All I could do was laugh. How absurd. Are they really unaware of places like Los Alamos National Laboratory and Oak Ridge National Laboratory and Sandia? And GE and Westinghouse and a whole bunch of other people. All kinds of places where high security and very talented people. As a matter of fact, I checked a few years ago, and the total budget for the three nuclear weapons labs was greater than the total budget of the National Science Foundation on all its projects. All. So it is nonsense to think that only the academics do research. They may talk about a professor and six grad students, or three professors and 20 grad students. When I was working at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department in Cincinnati, 1956 through 59, in 1958, I checked out the numbers, our budget was $100 million, which was a lot of money in 58. And we employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. That's not a few professors and a bunch of grad students. And we did a lot of research on nuclear airplanes. We never flew a nuclear-powered airplane. We did have a reactor on board an airplane to do radiation shielding tests, and that's another story. But the point is, if you're going to talk about something as controversial and exciting and different as flying saucers, you ought to have a responsibility, if you claim to be a scientist, to do your homework first. That's not an unreasonable demand. So, yeah, I'm ticked off at these guys. So let's push the button and see what happens. You saw about this early, but and somebody just wrote a very negative article about me. He's always talking about that old Project Blue Book, Special Report 14, which nobody reads. No, that's the problem. Nobody reads it. It's the largest study ever done for the United States Air Force. It was done by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. They looked at a total of 3,201 sightings. The report has over 250 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. It's got data that nobody else has published anywhere, but they don't think I should be looking at it, bringing it up. I've checked my audiences, over 700 around the world, and if I'm lucky, I find 1% who've read it. And why do I refer to it? Because it's got answers to the questions you'd like to ask. What fraction of sightings that have been reported to the Air Force could not be explained, for example? And there are tables in the report. Here's where the Secretary of the Air Force made his classic statement. We believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers were overflown in the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been explained as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been obtained. That's the Secretary of the Air Force. That press release appeared all across the country. Now, it didn't give the title for the report. Surely if they had said Blue Book Special Report 14, the press would have said, hey, what happened to 1 through 13? We've never heard anything about them. The correct answer, had it been given, was that they were all classified. They weren't about to say that. Were the unknowns 3%? No, they were 21.5%. Now, that's not a round-off of 3. 3 isn't almost 21.5, you know. It's not even close. There's the categorization. And notice the next to the last claim, insufficient information. They go out of their way to stress. If there was vital information missing from a case, it could not be listed as an unknown. It had to be listed as insufficient information. So the Secretary of the Air Force saying that even the unknowns could have been explained if more complete observational data had been available is simply a lie. I don't like being lied to. What really got me into the business of serious investigation of UFOs was finding this report at the University of California, Berkeley, after having read roughly a dozen books, none of which mentioned it, so it came as quite a shock to me, and then being lied to by the Secretary of the Air Force. Taint right. And you'll notice there the psychological cases. The American Physical Society, to which I and most physicists belong, says that 2% of the papers submitted to them by their physicist members are crackpot papers. That means there's more crackpots associated with physics than with flying saucers. I'm one of the few with a foot in each camp, you understand. But here's the quality evaluation that I mentioned earlier. Now, notice, the better the quality, the more likely to be an unknown, which is what you'd expect if they were carefully examining these cases. If it's a poor quality report, it's not likely to be an unknown. It's likely to be almost anything else. You notice that last column, insufficient information. For the excellent cases, only 3.9% had insufficient information. For the poor cases, 19.6%. So this was a careful, well-done study. That doesn't mean they didn't lie about it. Look, when I was in industry, I read lots of reports, and when I did a weekly science commentary for CBC Radio in Fredericton, New Brunswick for 6 years, I'd always find papers where the upfront conclusions often were contradicted by the data in the back of the report. But those upfront conclusions were intended for management. Nobody bothers to check. And I had some egregious examples that I found, the medical stories and stuff like that. When you go back and look at the data, you find it isn't what they claimed it was up front. So I mention this study because it should be mentioned by anybody who makes crazy claims about the data. Crazy meaning unsubstantiated claims. On the left, the UFO evidence. This was put out by the old National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP. Major Donald Kehoe, some of you may have read his books years ago. And in the UFO evidence, 18% of the 4,500 cases investigated could not be explained. 18%! On the right, that congressional hearings document, Symposium on Unidentified Flying Objects, hearings before the House Committee on Aeronautics and Astronautics. I was one of the 12 participants. I gave written testimony, as did 5 others, and 6 gave in-person testimony. Of course, the noisy negativists never talk about this study. I mentioned there was an astronomer who said only kooks see UFOs. 3 of the participants were astronomers. He, of course, doesn't reference the report. I mean, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up, you know. That's the idea here. The Condon report, as I mentioned, 30% of the cases they looked at couldn't be explained. Alan Hynek, an astronomer, You'd think he'd be the first point of reference for an astronomer saying only kooks see UFOs. But he's not even mentioned. He was chairman of the astronomy department at Northwestern University, Air Force scientific consultant of Project Blue Book for 20 years. Who would be more qualified to get an opinion from, especially when he's written a book? But, of course, we're not going to mention him. Now, the propulsion system. I've got some rare pictures. At least you won't see them everywhere. This is an early model of a possible nuclear-powered airplane. If you look down below, you'll see the two engines on the left bottom of this thing. They were in a water-cooled reactor that heated the air, which went through the turbine, which went through the engines. And this thing is all mounted on a railroad car because it gets quite radioactive after you've operated a bit. So you want to handle it remotely. You don't want to have a bunch of guys running around pushing on the thing. That was about 1956. That's what a flight-type system would look like. The reactor would be roughly 5 feet in diameter in the middle there. Those are big engines. I remember going up to see them at GE when I was working there, and big enough to walk in the inlet when the normal engine used at that time was half that size. Now, what's the benefit of a nuclear-powered airplane? Well, it can operate for thousands of hours without refueling. You change the crew, but you don't have to refuel. And so unlimited range, this was height of the Cold War. The only problem is GE had no guts because they didn't have any stake in the program. It was a cost-plus contract. They owned the rug on the boss's floor, the government facility. And that was it. Program got canceled, so what's the big deal? And there was no leadership. In contrast with the nuclear Navy, some of you may remember the name of Admiral Hyman Rickover. He was a damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead kind of guy. You don't want to go where we're going, get off the train. And that's why we have nuclear submarines and nuclear-powered carriers, and they've had some cruisers and other things. The difference it makes is when you're nuclear power, you can go full speed ahead and keep going and keep going and keep going. With a regular ship, you can't do that, or a regular airplane, you can't do that. You got to refuel. And that can be difficult in wartime. Kind of a neat system. There were several different programs. Pratt Whitney had a project, too. Theirs was a liquid metal-cooled reactor. A little problem with liquid metal-to-air heat exchanger, incidentally. The exhaust temperature of the air was running about 1,800 degrees. With the submarine, the exhaust temperature of the water was about 1,000 degrees. And when you get up to 1,800, it's tough on materials. There's a nuclear-powered ramjet. The idea of this, of course, Link Temco bought, was to carry it up by a B-52, have it loaded with nuclear bombs, and release it, and it would fly any place in the planet to drop the bombs. And that got built. That program got canceled, too, of course. But they did operate one of these things on the ground. Here's a layout of several nuclear-powered rocket systems. There's a man in the middle there to get some idea of the size. Different power levels, different thrust levels. This is a 1968. Yeah, that's about right. The idea is you take liquid hydrogen, very cold, you pump it through the reactor and out through the nozzle, and it comes out at about 4,400 degrees. Very high thrust because there's no oxygen coming out. Normal chemical rockets, hydrogen and kerosene, other things. These are heavy. Hydrogen's light. And the nice thing, too, is hydrogen is the most abundant most abundant element in the universe. Wherever you go, you're going to find hydrogen. Part of the ocean, of course, is made of hydrogen, H2O, you know, hydrocarbons. These were fun to work on. Now, you don't want to be next to them when they're operating. Very hot, radioactive. There is the NRX-A6. I worked on that for Westinghouse. reactors in the middle, nozzle upward firing. These were tested out near Area 51 at the nuclear test site, about 75 miles outside of Las Vegas, not in the middle of nowhere. And it really is in the middle of nowhere. There's a good reason if you're operating nuclear-powered systems. You don't really don't want many people, even jackrabbits, around. You know, not healthy for the system. Here's another one. This is one of Los Alamos's. Again, on a remote carrier. Here's what it looks like out there. Area 51's on the other side of those mountains. And that is a plume from one of these things. The tanks are liquid hydrogen. You're limited how long it can operate for how much you can store, because once you've operated for a while, it gets radioactive, becomes temperature hot, and you better have enough coolant to keep it cooled down. And there were people who said you can never operate a rocket with hydrogen. It's too dangerous, which reminds me of the cities that passed ordinance about storing gasoline for cars back at the turn of the 19th century, 20th century. And most cities do have gasoline stored for their cars, of course, because we learn how to handle this stuff. I mentioned fusion earlier. These are the same equations. The point is, you've moved up the ladder of universal communities once you've figured out what makes the stars work. It took us a while. Not surprising, for goodness sakes. Didn't know about neutrons till 1931. Didn't know about fusion until 1938. Our first nuclear chain reaction was 1942 at the University of Chicago under the stands at the squash courts at the University of Chicago. It wasn't that long ago, in other words, that we were moving toward joining the community of nations, at least by knowing what produces the energy in the stars. That's a big step, a very big step. There were people who said the sun could only be 30 million years old because it wasn't enough fuel to fuel it for longer than that, because they were talking about chemical reactions. It doesn't use chemical reactions. It uses nuclear fusion. And, you know, you can't complain about somebody who in 1900 didn't know about this. But in the year 2000, you'd think they'd be smart enough, if they're scientists, to be aware of this. The data's all over the place. So helium and deuterium is heavy water, heavy hydrogen. Normal hydrogen has got a proton in the middle and an electron on the outside. Deuterium, you add a neutron in the middle. Makes it twice as heavy, and its nuclear properties are a little different. And it's fundamental to the production of energy in the universe. We didn't discover until 1932. So the point here is you think that maybe somebody out there got started a little bit before we did. They're going to know some things that we don't know. And when they learned what we have finally learned, it was probably a long time ago. That's the way things are. And if somebody's coming here, we know they discovered some secrets we don't have. And the point, as I mentioned earlier, was a lot of energy and charged particles, which you can direct out the rocket that way. And incidentally, it only takes 1 year at 1G to get to the speed of light. And you say, well, wait a minute now. Einstein said as you get close to the speed of light, time slows down for things moving that fast. Now, don't ask me why. That's the way the universe is created, according to Albert. And he turned out his ideas have stood up extremely well for a very long time. But what that means is if you can go 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light years in 6 months, pilot time. You go out, come back, marry your granddaughter's best friend. You know, it's kind of a neat system. And you say, well, that's just theoretical. No, it isn't. When we design accelerators, we have to take this into account. When cosmic rays come in, and they were a great surprise when somebody discovered them. It's kind of interesting. The guy was measuring radioactivity coming from the ground. We didn't find out about radioactivity until about 1900. So he's making measurements as a function of height from the ground. And amazingly, the values went up as he went up. Well, they should have gone down. Come on. The ground's down here. You're up here. The further away you get, the less the radiation levels are. That's how he discovered cosmic rays. He made measurements from higher altitudes. There was stuff coming in from outside that we didn't even know was there. And having an influence on the clouds, it's a whole long story. But there are cosmic rays, even though we didn't know about them. You see, the idea is if we don't know about it, it doesn't exist, which is nonsense. That's not science. That's bias, prejudice, ignorance, you know, that sort of stuff. So when I talk about fusion being your entrance into the universal community of advanced nations, I don't mean there isn't something beyond that. I just mean that's good enough to get us where we want to go. And every darn scientist should know this. There's the question, isn't it? Never mind the saucer. Just see the guys who were driving. Does a nuclear physicist believe in little green men? Well, they're not green. They usually are little. And yes, there are plenty of reports of small beings associated with landed saucers. There are many physical trace cases. You never hear anybody talking about this. No physical evidence. It's all eyewitness testimony. I don't think radar reports are eyewitness testimony. You can record them on from the screen, you know, stuff like that. Physical trace cases like this, is Delphos, Kansas. Ted Phillips of Missouri has collected more than 4,000 such cases. When you see the saucer sitting on or near the ground, and after it leaves, one finds physical changes. The equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks. Not crop circles. This one is Delphos, Kansas. I've been there. The soil down 14 inches in that 10-foot diameter ring was different in color and texture from the soil nearby. And it wouldn't grow anything. We have lots of such cases. There was a witness. The dirt on the left is normal dirt. The dirt on the right was from the affected ring. And don't get mad at me for using a paper plate. That's a sophisticated soil retention device, please. When I was at the University of Chicago, there was a Nobel Prize-winning physics experiment where they use an empty coffee can to hold up an important piece of equipment. If they can use a coffee can, I can use a paper plate. The famous Betty and Barney Hill story, as I mentioned earlier, the star map that tells us where those guys probably originate. There's Marjorie Fish, who did the work on the star map. She's also a sculptress who made that statue, if you will. You can see this was taken a long time ago. Look at the color of my beard. Early 70s. That's one of her models. Incredible amount of effort to put the beads in the right place. It only takes two angles to specify where to aim a telescope to see a particular star. Because the astronomers aren't going anywhere. What difference does it make whether it's 20 light years away or 40 light years? But if you're trying to look at a three-dimensional model and see if you can find a pattern that matches a two-dimensional pattern, you better get the distances right. And so she gradually got rid of stars and finally found one pattern that matched angle for angle, line length for line length, what Betty had drawn. It was a happy day. The star in the upper right, there. I don't know if you can see them. Oh, there it is. Up there. That's the sun. It's kind of nice that the sun is in the pattern since they're coming here. And all the stars in the pattern are sun-like stars, and they're all in a plane. Think of slices of pepperoni on a big flat pizza, as opposed to raisins in a big fat loaf of raisin bread in all directions. What difference does it make? It's much easier to get to other stars if they're in the same plane, which is kind of nifty, in other words, for travel. So, exciting piece of work. And, yeah, all the numbers changed slightly because we finally got a good satellite up there. The Europeans did, European Space Agency. The Hipparco satellite measured the distances to hundreds of thousands of stars accurately, they did. And that's kind of neat. Doesn't really change the results. A monument to persistence and care. She was a member of Mensa, brilliant woman. Those are the names of the stars. Gliese is the name of the best catalog at that time. The distances have all changed slightly. And the base stars down at the bottom, Zeta 1 Reticuli and Zeta 2 Reticuli. And those other numbers, LY means light years. And they're all changed slightly, but it doesn't change the net results. This is based on Betty doing a drawing under the direction from the psychiatrist, Ben Simon, who did the hypnosis session, with the caveat, if she could remember it accurately. I wrote the first article on it in the infamous Saga magazine. And then I suggested to Terry Dickinson, editor of Astronomy magazine, that he do an article, and he did. He talked to a bunch of people, published an article, then he had letters over the next year, about 10 different letters, and he put out this 32-page full-color booklet. They sold 10,000 copies almost immediately, which is almost unheard of for this kind of thing. And then Carl Sagan's lawyer threatened to sue him because his name was on the front where it belongs, because he's one of the people who submitted a letter. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, so I wound up buying 18,000 copies of the Zeta Reticuli incident. And I'd sell you one, except I'm out of the darn things long ago. A lot of interest in them. It's a wonderful piece of work, if for no other reason than it shows that a persistent amateur. And in my movie UFOs Are Real, we have the head of the astronomy department at Ohio State University saying how accurate her work was. Dr. David Saunders was there with J. Allen Hynek when I introduced them to her, and she made a presentation about the work she was doing. David was very impressed, as was Allen. That's the bust she did. Your typical little gray man, if you want. Your typical Zeta Reticulan, whatever you want to call them. There's a book by Kathleen Martin and myself. And if you're wondering, so why is my name first? It's because the publisher insisted. It'll sell more, he says. Now, there's no way you can turn down a publisher who says if we do it this way, it'll sell more than if we do it that way. So we had my name be first. It's done pretty well, and it's been optioned for a movie as well. And you may remember a television movie with James Earl Jones playing Barney. There's been a lot of work done on this since, of course. I was a technical advisor on that film, and what's ironical is that the Universal Studios got my name from the Air Force. I was living in the Los Angeles area, and they're supposed to, when the Air Force got asked about UFOs, I'll refer him to a scientist. I was the local scientist on UFOs, I guess. It was kind of fun. And James Earl Jones, I don't know how many of you saw that movie, The UFO Incident with James Earl Jones. What an actor. What an actor. And it wasn't 100% accurate, but it was damn good. And if you get close to accurate, you're doing pretty well with Hollywood. Any Hollywood representatives here? Forget I said that. Incredible amount of effort to put the beads in the right place. It only takes two angles to specify where to aim a telescope to see a particular star. Because the astronomers aren't going anywhere, what difference does it make whether it's 20 light years away or 40 light years? But if you're trying to look at a three-dimensional model and see if you can find a pattern that matches a two-dimensional pattern, you better get the distances right. And so she gradually got rid of stars, and finally found one pattern that matched angle for angle, line length for line length, what Betty had drawn. It was a happy day. The star in the upper right there, I don't know if you can see them. Oh, there it is. Up there. That's the sun. It's kind of nice that the sun is in the pattern since they're coming here. And all the stars in the pattern are sun-like stars, and they're all in a plane. Think of slices of pepperoni on a big flat pizza, as opposed to raisins in a big fat loaf of raisin bread in all directions. What difference does it make? It's much easier to get to other stars if they're in the same plane, which is kind of nifty, in other words, for travel. So, exciting piece of work. And, yeah, all the numbers changed slightly because we finally got a good satellite up there. The Europeans did, European Space Agency. The Hipparco satellite measured the distances to hundreds of thousands of stars. accurately. They did. And it's kind of neat. Doesn't really change the results. A monument of persistence and care. She was a member of Mensa, brilliant woman. Those are the names of the stars. Gleasy is the name of the best catalog at that time. The distances have all changed slightly. And the base stars down at the bottom, Zeta 1 Reticuli and Zeta 2 Reticuli. And those other numbers, LY means light years. And they're all changed slightly, but it doesn't change the net results. This is based on Betty doing a drawing under the direction from the psychiatrist, Ben Simon, who did the hypnosis session, with the caveat, if she could remember it accurately. I wrote the first article on it in the infamous Saga magazine. And then I suggested to Terry Dickinson, editor of Astronomy magazine, that he do an article, and he did. He talked to a bunch of people, published an article, then he had letters over the next year, about 10 different letters, and he put out this 32-page full-color booklet. They sold 10,000 copies almost immediately, which is almost unheard of for this kind of thing. And then Carl Sagan's lawyer threatened to sue him because his name was on the front where it belongs because he's one of the people who submitted a letter. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, so I wound up buying 18,000 copies of the Zeta Reticuli incident. And I'd sell you one, except I'm out of the darn things long ago. A lot of interest in them. It's a wonderful piece of work, if for no other reason than it shows that a persistent amateur, and in my movie UFOs Are Real, we have the head of the astronomy department at Ohio State University saying how accurate her work was. Dr. David Saunders was there with J. Allen Hynek when I introduced them to her, and she made a presentation about the work she was doing. David was very impressed, as was Allen. That's the bust she did. Your typical little gray man, if you want. Your typical Zeta Reticulan, whatever you want to call them. There's a book by Kathleen Martin and myself. And if you're wondering, so why is my name first? It's because the publisher insisted. It'll sell more, he says. Now, there's no way you can turn down a publisher who says if we do it this way, it'll sell more than if we do it that way. So we had my name be first. It's done pretty well, and it's been optioned for a movie as well. And you may remember a television movie with James Earl Jones playing Barney. There's been a lot of work done on this since, of course. I was a technical advisor on that film, and what's ironical is that the Universal Studios got my name from the Air Force. I was living in the Los Angeles area, and they were supposed to, when the Air Force got asked about UFOs, I'll refer him to a scientist. I was the local scientist on UFOs, I guess. It was kind of fun. And James Earl Jones, I don't know how many of you saw that movie, The UFO Incident with James Earl Jones. What an actor. What an actor. And it wasn't 100% accurate, but it was damn good. And if you get close to accurate, you're doing pretty well with Hollywood. Any Hollywood representatives here? Forget I said that. Now, there is a congressman from Minnesota who was doing a television show that I went to do in New York, and I sent them a bunch of stuff in advance. And Carl Flock and I, another researcher, were sort of arguing about some of the things. And I'll be darned if he doesn't come on and say that couldn't have been a big story, that Roswell story, if it only appeared in the Roswell paper. I'd send him articles from the Chicago paper, like this one, from San Francisco paper, from a Sacramento paper, from a Spokane paper. Appeared all over the place. He hadn't bothered to look at them. I don't consider that a very scientific approach to things either. You know, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. And what you have to understand about the publicity back then, it was pre-television for the most part, and the time zones got in the way. If you put something out in New Mexico at noon, it's too late for all the papers on the East Coast. Made it to Chicago and cities west. And the cover story appears with, let's see if we have it. There's the Roswell paper. And somebody insisted to me, made a big fuss at me after a lecture, that RAF, RAAF is Royal Australian Air Force. No, I'm sorry, it's Roswell Army Airfield. That's the front page of the Roswell paper. There's New Mexico. Roswell's in the middle of nowhere, down in the lower right-hand corner there. 200 miles of nothing between it and Albuquerque, El Paso, and Amarillo. If you're in Roswell, boy, you want to be there. It's not on the way to any place. And yet, when we had the 50th anniversary celebration, there were thousands and thousands of people and 300 newsmen there. And each year at the festival, we had thousands of people, and they built new motels and stuff, and I don't even get a cut. It's not fair. That yellow base is White Sands Missile Range, which is where the first atomic bomb was tested, where we're testing to capture German V-2s. Now, there's Major Marcel in General Ramey's office. Ramey's office was in Fort Worth, Texas, headquarters of the 8th Air Force. Colonel Blanchard, the head of the base at Roswell, instructed Jesse, first of all, to go out to the crash site after the rancher came into town when he said there was lots of this stuff out there. Went out there, brought back some of the stuff, and Colonel Blanchard says, take it to 8th Air Force headquarters at Fort Worth. And, of course, he followed instructions. And when he got there, General Ramey, head of the 8th Air Force, Blanchard's boss, says, you don't say anything. I'll take care of it. And he told the press that it was just a radar reflector from a weather balloon, which wasn't the material that Jesse brought with him from Roswell. And the press bought it hook, line, and sinker. And so the newspapers changed the story after 4 hours, or the next day for most papers. Let me say it politely. They lied. I was the first to talk to Jesse, 1978. Now, there's General Ramey on the left, Colonel Dubose on the right. I found Dubose. I presumed he probably was a West Pointer. Ramey was dead. Blanchard was dead when I got involved in all this stuff. But I checked with West Point, and sure enough, Thomas Jefferson Dubose, graduate. They told me he lived in Florida. I called. He was up north at the time, but came back, made contact with him, visited with him. He's in my movie Recollections of Roswell, which has testimony from 27 witnesses, almost all of whom are now dead. But he put it on the line. He took the call from Ramey's boss, giving him three orders. Get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it. Send some of that wreckage up here today with one of your colonel couriers. He was in Washington. And I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing, Colonel? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it, especially when they know each other. And both West Pointers, incidentally. I mean, you get people asking, well, why didn't he complain? This is right after the war. You follow orders. It's not a question of do you jump. It's how high should I jump. That's the way things were. That's not an indictment of any way. That's how you run a war. You notice that General Ramey's holding a piece of paper in his hand there, lower left. Well, because they used a fancy speed graphic camera with much better resolution than today's digital cameras, it turns out, with a lot of care, you can read most of this memo. And it includes things like victims of the wreck. All balloons have victims of their wrecks, don't they? Somebody's read it. It's very much a statement of there having been a crash, saucer with bodies. There's Tommy Dubose. Great guy. Took us to the nicest restaurant in Orlando. Don Schmidt and I interviewed him after that first interview with me. He was in his late 80s when he died, incidentally. A real gentleman. He set up the Air Force's search and rescue teams, incidentally. He was an instructor pilot. Quite a guy. This is the next day's paper. They grabbed the rancher, brought him into the base. They gave him a new story. And that got run, too. He was told to lie, and he did. Under duress, but what the heck. And as I mentioned earlier, the Air Force put out a report making the absurd explanation that it was crash test dummies like this one that people referred to as bodies, even though none were dropped until 6 years after Roswell. If you call that a scientific conclusion, boy, you're one up on me. Time travel for crash test dummies. Why don't we use it for people? Save a lot on fuel, you know. And I did talk to the man on the right. And I like the fact that this is in an Air Force flight uniform. Any rancher finding that would, of course, think, oh, this is the latest in alien Air Force gear. You know, how dumb can you get? But the New York Times bought it. What else matters? Now, in 1984, a roll of film showed up in the mailbox of a man named Jamie Chandray in California. Jamie and I and Bill Moore had worked together on Roswell stuff for several years. And here comes this roll of film. When it was processed, two sets of eight negatives each of a top secret MAJIC, M-A-J-I-C, document, a briefing for President-elect Eisenhower, dated 18 November, 1952. And it states that President Truman authorized the establishment of a group called Operation Majestic 12. Named the 12 guys, outstanding group, said they were accountable only to the president. All but one, as far as we knew at the time, seemed to have high-level security clearances because of the work that they were doing at the time in 1947 when the group was established. The one came as a shocker. I mentioned earlier Donald Menzel, Harvard University astronomer, total debunker of UFOs. How could he be on a group that knew that there had been a crash saucer and alien bodies recovered? Didn't make sense. But I checked it out. I had to get permission from three people to see his files at Harvard. Son of a gun. He wrote to Jack Kennedy that he had a longer continuous connection with the National Security Agency. NSA, no such agency, never says anything. They're the guys who spy on everybody, you know, and all that stuff. Turns out Menzel was a world-class cryptographer. Had a longer connection with the NSA and its Navy predecessor of anybody in the country, he said to Jack Kennedy. Pretty shocking to me because I didn't like him. The briefing officer was Admiral Roscoe Hillencoder, who was the director of Central Intelligence in 1947. You'll recognize some of those names. Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, General Nathan Twining went on to be chief of staff of the Air Force, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Hoyt Vandenberg had been head of the CIA and chairman, Air Force chief of staff. And there's Donald Menzel, third from the bottom. I checked out all these guys, and they all made sense except Menzel. So I looked at his paper and found out he made sense, too, much to everybody's surprise. Can you keep secrets? Of course you can. This is a letter from Truman to Forrestal establishing the group. I've been at the Forrestal Library with his papers. I love going to archives. There's something handled, something specific, detailed. This is the authorization. I talked to somebody who worked for Truman the entire time he was in the White House. Could he find anything wrong with this document? No. And he told me a lot of other stuff that was useful. Now, here's one. This is the one that Phil Klass said, oh, that's a phony. It's the large Pica type. They only use the small elite type, and he had nine documents to prove it. Of course, he's never been to the Eisenhower Library. He didn't make note of the fact they had 250,000 pages of NSC, National Security Council materials. It's kind of a big jump from nine to 250,000. And, of course, I'd been spent time there, and he made it worth my while to go back again. offered me $100 each for every genuine document done in the same size and style type, FICA type. I sent him 20 out of my office file cabinet, and I knew he wouldn't allow some because he had criteria. And then I was going to the Eisenhower Library anyway, so I quickly picked up 14 more, sent him copies and an invoice for $1,000. He set a limit, unfortunately, of maximum of 10. I'd have been a wealthy man. I'd have kept looking for another day at the library. There's a watermark on the paper. The paper dates to the right time and place and all kinds of good things. And it's all in my book, Top Secret Magic, and I can't sell you a copy because I'm out of them until I get home. And there's this check to me for $1,000. And he got madder than hell when I published it in a report I wrote. Threatened to sue me. And I said, Phil, you sent me a check. I Xeroxed it. I took the check to the bank. They cashed it. I can do whatever I darn please with the Xerox. And then he shut up, because that's true. But for those who don't think, you know, he never told anybody about paying me, of course. And his papers are at the American Philosophical Society Library in Philadelphia. 35 cases of material. And there is no Friedman file, even though we had a large correspondence. So nobody would know about this who went to check out the files. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up, you see. I asked his wife, believe it or not, if she knew of any other place where his papers might be, and she said no. Now, I can't say he destroyed them. All I can say is I don't know where they are, and they're not where they should be, and I have copies, though, so anybody who wants a copy, I can provide. Nasty? No. Revenge. There's the book, Top Secret Magic. Now, Jesse Marcel, Jr., Dr. Jesse Marcel, he was a flight surgeon, helicopter pilot, as I mentioned earlier, 225 combat hours in Iraq. And none of his titles were mentioned when he was interviewed in that mockumentary that I talked about earlier, which I think smells of rotten journalism. That was the Peter Jennings mockumentary. Crash at Corona, that's my book with Don Berliner. The definitive study of the Roswell incident. Where does Corona come in? That's actually the small town closest to where the events took place. Roswell's where the base was. It's where the military were. That's where the action was. But Corona is the town closest to the site of the crash. And I have a few copies of Recollections of Roswell, firsthand testimony from 27 witnesses. There was a rich European head of a country, owns a country, big art collector. He sponsored bringing all these people there. We filmed them, and I'm glad we did, because we have them on record, not secondhand testimony, talking to the camera. And the ones who we couldn't get there, we went out and talked to. So that's being scientific. If these guys have anything to say, let's find out. Let's not say A talked to B, who talked to C, who said that D said something. You can listen to them. Decide on your own. New Mexico is kind of a special place. People trust each other. You know, they don't lock their doors. This is back then anyway. I like the place because the people are like that. And I've got people saying, why would anybody live in New Mexico? That sheriff must have been a redneck. He had a college degree, and his three kids had about five between them. They like living out there, and I don't blame them one little bit. And I've given the rules for the debunkers. You can't read them from there, and I'm sorry, but they're what you might expect. Four major rules. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. Do research by proclamation, because investigation is too much trouble. All of those are in violation of the scientific spirit of how you're supposed to get at truth. It applies not only to UFOs. Pick any subject that you want to attack. Those are the rules. Easy to do. Simple and straightforward. And then, of course, I like some of the corollaries. Absence of evidence is evidence for absence. All believers are liars. All non-believers only tell the truth. And it goes on. But this isn't the only area where this is true. I'll show you some pictures. This is Hawaii. Look at the UFO up above, not the girls below, please. I think that's an ionized air region behind the craft related to a magneto-aerodynamic propulsion system similar to the electromagnetic submarine built back in the 60s by a Westinghouse scientist. There's four pictures taken in Salt Lake City, Utah. You'll see the Mormon temple there on the right on number three. The date's given there. I stood at the exact location where the pictures were taken. Look at number five. Again, I think it's an ionized air plasma related to a magneto-aerodynamic propulsion system. And I get people saying, how come the pictures are only just lights in the sky at night? The answer is that's not true. Simply not true. This is Santa Ana, California, 1964. Got 100 pages of analysis of these pictures. They've been published. It was taken by a guy who worked for Santa Ana County, driving along in his vehicle, had a Polaroid camera, took pictures through the window. This is a lousy copy of it. I got to get that changed. From McMinnville, Oregon. Articles have been published in scientific journals about these pictures. And even the University of Colorado couldn't find an explanation for this other than, you know, an unidentified flying object. Island of Trindade, east of the coast of Brazil. Object comes in from the right, as you can see from the numbers. Saturn-shaped object. Circles around, goes back out, upper right-hand corner. 40 guys on the deck of the ship watch this object. Official Brazilian Navy, part of the International Geophysical Year, photographer took the pictures. They were developed on board the ship, and they were eventually released to the public by the president of Brazil, Juscelino Kubitschek. And everybody knows he was a liar and a fraud and put out phony stuff, right? No, not right at all. This is back, it's funny, there was a recent article of somebody saying, oh, Arthur C. Clarke, if there had been anything to UFOs, they would have been seen during the International Geophysical Year. Yeah, Arthur, they were. And here are some of the pictures taken with witnesses around. You know, I get a little irked when people say there aren't any decent pictures and only lights in the sky at night that could be anything and stuff like that. That is not a light in the sky. It's not at night. It sure doesn't look like anything conventional. And it was around long enough for four pictures to be taken and released to the public by the president of Brazil. Now, of course, there's no cover-ups. I showed this earlier, but there's a typical CIA UFO document that it took me 5 years to get about UFOs by their statement, not mine. This is my favorite document. They couldn't even find six lousy words to declassify on this. Deny in toto. This is a story of 1952, especially the Flatwoods Monster case. That was the year in which orders were issued to shoot them down if they don't land when ordered to do so. And that's where I have heard several people tell me about airplanes not going up, not coming back after being sent up to shoot them down. And an Air Force general said, we've scrambled more than 300 times, just routine. And, of course, Air Force generals always tell the truth. We know that. There's my 168 minutes of a, it's a two CD set. I have a few of those left. But it's the big picture. You can find out all kinds of stuff here. There's Seth Shostak. I told you about him before, the SETI Institute. I'm hoping he will read that book of mine that's on his nightstand. I doubt it. Enrico Fermi. Now, there's a popular mythology that Fermi, when with other associates, was leaving Los Alamos at lunch. They'd been talking about it would only take a couple million years to colonize the entire galaxy. And so as they were leaving, Fermi, who was famous for asking questions as a teaching tool, I went to the University of Chicago because he was there. He died while I was there. It had nothing to do with me. I don't mean that. But, uh-oh, here comes Friedman. Oh. You know. But what he said was, so where is everybody? He didn't say there's nobody coming here, and it's a legitimate question. And my answer is, I don't know where everybody is, but I know some of them are coming here, and the government knows a great deal and isn't telling us anything about what they know. But people say, it's the Fermi paradox, it's called. There's a whole book about it. There are hundreds of explanations for what people meant. The simplest is he had some inkling that there was stuff going on, and he was asking that question. You know, what's the best explanation? Fermi had a security clearance. He put together the first nuclear chain reaction for building the bomb. And he was present when the bomb was set off, incidentally. He had presence of mind to sprinkle little pieces of paper for when the shockwave came by, and by measuring the distance they went from where he had dropped them, he could tell the power of the blast. Fermi was a physicist. When he died, his colleagues, who were no mean shakes either, spoke of him with awe, because he was both an experimentalist and a theoretician. That's very unusual. So people have misrepresented what he said. And one of the ironies of this is Fermi's wife, Laura, was Jewish. So when he went to get his Nobel Prize in Oslo in 1938, Mussolini, they were living in Italy, and Mussolini was clamping down a la Hitler. They went to Oslo, went to the United States, and never went back to Italy. And there were a number of other people working on the nuclear weapons program who got to the United States because of Hitler's nastiness in Europe. Served him right is all I can say. Because if he had had all these guys, he might have gotten there before we did. Which is a very scary thought indeed. But don't let anybody tell you that Fermi said there were no visitors from elsewhere. Where is everybody? There's my book. I think I have a couple of copies left. And by a miracle of great proportions, my box of books wound up coming here this afternoon. Thanks to Ishmael's daughter who called and said, the books are here. And I've been pestering them, of course. Where are my books? I sent them. Well, they arrived. And most of them are gone, but there's a few left. I don't know. But there have been past discussions about grand alignments. And nothing really has come of them. Except they do make it more convenient if you're going to check on the outer planets to launch your rocket so that they get there when they're lined up. You can go past several of them. And I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen with the Mayan calendar. I think they ran out of stone. And I've heard that the Mayans, today's Mayans, if you will, have all said that the story is not that the world ends at that time. It takes a new turn. That's a big difference. So I'm not ready to lay down and say, hey, let's have a ball because everything's coming to an end at the end of December. My wife's birthday is the end of December. Maybe we should have a party if we live that long, 28th. It's pushing it, but what the heck. So I have no reason to say anything's going to happen. There are always alignments and other things going on, and you can attach whatever significance you want to them. I will say this. In the chapter in Science Was Wrong, we have a chapter on global the climate business, anthropogenic global warming, man-induced. And incidentally, don't believe what you hear. CO2 is not the villain. I get a kick out of people saying, ban CO2. Every living plant on the planet needs CO2. It's not a pollutant. and the temperatures were higher at times when there wasn't any man-made CO2 around. So you're getting a bad scoop. Now, there's guys with a vested interest, the IPCC. They got plush jobs, great opportunities to be somebody, and don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. And, you know, they told you that the glaciers were melting. No, they weren't. Yes, it's been warmer in the north and colder in the south. Antarctica is warmer than usual, colder than usual, where the Arctic is warmer than usual. Nature goes through cycles. Sorry, that's the way it is. You know, you can't control them. So don't be worried. As a matter of fact, they're going broke in England and Germany, putting out all kinds of subsidizing money for windmills, which are very inefficient and so forth, and which the public has to pay for, and which don't work all the time. You know, I know, I'm sure it comes as a surprise to everybody that the wind doesn't blow all the time, and the sun doesn't shine all the time. Isn't that amazing? 45 windmills in the northern part of New Brunswick stopped when the weather got too cold and froze everything. So you can rate the windmill at 100 kilowatts. And once in a while, it'll produce that much. Much of the time, it won't. So there's a lot of popular mythology, if you will. And you got to be careful. And I know there are people who say, oh, he's full of baloney. Well, there's a chapter in Science Was Wrong where I cite chapter and verse as to why I say what I say about it. So I don't know of any grand alignment that's going to do anything to hurt anything. That's different from saying there isn't a grand alignment. I don't know. That's what people are saying. I wasn't around the last time. I don't expect I'll be around the next time after this one anyway. So there are a lot of these things where you got people pushing their own petty theories because it sounds good, and who's going to check on them? They get a lot of press coverage. Scientists fears terrible event to happen, you know. Rumor mongering is a great way to get press. Was that the English article? And they said there were, it's been going down, and yeah, I read that article, baloney from beginning to end. The number of sightings wasn't decreasing. You know, how many UFO sightings are there? Well, if I check my normal lecture audiences, I get 10% of them believe they've seen one. When I ask how many of you reported what you saw, 90% of the hands go down. So your view of what's going on, you're looking at a small subset. And if the press coverage is good, maybe it goes up to 20% reported instead of 10. Oh, twice as much. Only 5% reported. Only half as much. Oh, my goodness, nothing's happening. But you never see the support of research. The reference is saying, according to this study done by so-and-so and published hither or yon. And so I saw the article. I was not impressed, to say the least. Sorry. That's as bad as the article about only kooks see UFOs by the British Astronomer Royal. Other questions. Robert Scott Lazar. Yes, go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and you'll find an article about the fraud of Bob Lazar. That tells you where I'm coming from. But a quick look at things. You know, most of you have probably heard of Bob Lazar. He claimed to have been a nuclear physicist with a master's in physics from MIT and another one in electronics from Caltech. Worked at Los Alamos. Got hired by Area 51 to back engineer UFOs. Figure out how they work. And the kicker is I got asked about him all the time because I'm a nuclear physicist and, you know, here's a fellow scientist, etc. So first of all, I checked the American Physical Society and the American Nuclear Society. I belong to both. He doesn't belong to either. Second, I checked with MIT, five different people there. Nobody ever heard of him. Third, I checked with his high school and found out that he finished in the bottom third of his high school class. He couldn't possibly have gotten into MIT. You got to be in the top 10 or 20%. I checked at Caltech. They never heard of him. At a talk he gave, he announced as somebody who would remember him from physics department at Caltech, William Duxler. I found Dr. Duxler. He was a physicist. He did teach physics at Pierce Junior College, which isn't far from Caltech. Geographically, it's very far intellectually. I've spoken there. I mean, I've been there. He said Los Alamos had 500 pounds of element 115. No way with a half-life less than a second. and he didn't repeat that many times after I made that point. I was asked what it would take by one of his buddies to convince me about him. I said, well, scientists have diplomas. They have resumes. They publish papers. They belong to professional groups. I sent him a bunch of stuff about myself, including copies of my diplomas. And, of course, I got nothing back from Bob. Sorry. If you want to contact him, last I heard he was running a company named United Nuclear up in Michigan. He'll sell you supplies for your little lab. He's this bright guy, built a jet-powered car. It's kind of neat. He did work. His phone number's in the book at Los Alamos in the phone book, but the number's after it, K/M, Kirk Meyer Corporation. There were subcontractors. When I called the lab to ask about him, he didn't work for the lab. Worked for a subcontractor. Everybody who's at the lab has to be in the phone book. I mean, this is not a casual place, Los Alamos. And yes, I've been there. So all I can say is he's not telling the truth. And if anybody knows that he is, please show me some evidence. You know, and I've talked to George Knapp, who was boosting him for a while. George cooperated. He told me what high school and so forth, and checked on him. And so I did all I could. Part of it, I will admit, I was angry because I was valedictorian of my high school class. I got admitted to MIT, but couldn't afford to go. Tuition was $900 a year. Now it's $24,000, I think. So I resented Bob saying he'd gone there, because a couple of my friends who I would have been with if I'd been able to afford it went there. And it was a tough, difficult school, and they finished the course. And so I resented somebody making a claim which wasn't substantiatable. There's more to the story, but, I mean, that's enough to give you some idea. Sorry, wrong number. Other questions? Yes. What he said was, when normally when a less advanced civilization meets with a more advanced one, think of the American Indians, for example, and the Europeans, it's the less advanced one that tends to suffer. That's true. What are you saying? We have suffered? Well, I think we haven't really met with them on an equal level. We don't have monthly meetings. What's the latest problems we can work on together, folks? We know there's a book by Robert Hastings called Nukes and UFOs. They have interfered with our nuclear systems. 10 Minuteman missiles that went down at Malmstrom Air Force Base, one after the other, when a UFO showed up at the gate. It's not supposed to happen. But it did. And I've talked to the people who were involved. And there have been other cases. And it's happened in Russia, too. And they seem to be concerned about us. There was even a press conference at the Press Society in Washington about this, with testimony from officers who'd been involved in this stuff. So they seem to be paying attention to us. Anybody be crazy not to? We're the scourge of the neighborhood, or we can expect to be if we get out there. Look at our track record. More than 50 million killed in World War II. 1,700 cities destroyed. We're spending $1 trillion this year on things military. We're not nice guys. Nobody in his right mind would want us out there. How many kids died yesterday from preventable disease and starvation? Well, we spent $1 trillion this past year on things military. That's not a trivial question. So I don't think we're nice guys. And I think everybody in the neighborhood would be keeping their eyes open for any scourges like us. As soon as we get to the point where we know about nuclear fusion and can produce it ourselves, we are a threat, because it can be used for propulsion as well as for destruction. 10 million times as much energy per particle going out the back end as in a chemical rocket. We can get to the stars. Expensive? Sure. Nuclear weapons were expensive too. Lots of money. So, yeah, we won't benefit. We may try to from the wreckage at Roswell and the wreckage at several other places, Aztec. Varginha in Brazil, other places. But I don't think the aliens are helping us. Look, you don't give a three-year-old a loaded gun to play with. Well, except here in Texas, but I mean, sorry. Question, yes. That's like saying, which of your kids is the best kid? Obviously, Roswell and the Hill case intrigued the heck out of me. But I'm also intrigued by the physical trace cases, and I'm intrigued by the case I mentioned earlier with Jim McDonald and investigated with the RB-47 with a six-man crew of highly trained military people. The sighting lasted for an hour. They saw it. They saw it on their radar. The ground radar saw them and the UFO. It circled around the airplane, which is a pretty neat trick at high speed. They picked up a signal from the darn thing, which was really scary. That is a very exciting case, and Jim talked to all six of the crew members. We got a lot of those military pilot kind of cases. The Lieutenant Coyne case in Ohio. Helicopter crew, army guys, saucer comes toward them, green light, their copter got lifted up quite a bit, went on about its business. Those guys were experienced crew members, and there were ground witnesses to see this happen, which is intriguing. You know, I like serving military people. They lie with great risk to themselves. You know what I mean? They can't just get casually make remarks. They'll be held accountable. So there are a lot of cases like that. There's some other abduction cases, which you'll be hearing more about. Kathy Marden, who did most of the work on Captured, is working on a second book about abductions and has a couple of very good cases in it. These guys are doing, they're grabbing us and looking at us and examining us, and who knows what the hell they're doing with the data, but it's going on. Maybe they're trying to find the genetic defect in Earthlings that makes them so darn warlike and nasty. I don't know. Maybe they want it for themselves. Who knows? Yes. Well, I've heard there's a lot of stories around about Chihuahua, Mexico. I'll have to talk to my Mexican-American colleagues. Noe, where are you? Oh, well, that's different. Dugway is not in southern Utah. Yeah, that's not Dugway, because that's in the north. Look, there is the base right next to Las Vegas. What's the name of the air base right there? Nellis Air Force Base, yes. And who knows what all goes on there and in all the other places. The government's got plenty of classified bases. They have every right to do that. What they have found out about aliens, they ain't telling us, that's for sure. So I can't enlighten you. I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Show it to me later. Question. Are they what? Safe, yes. There's over 400 nuclear reactors in the world, and yes, they're safe. They've got a darn good record, and don't tell me about Fukushima. The earthquake did a lot of damage, but the tsunami got rid of the fuel for the backup fuel systems. Bad deal all the way around. But nuclear power plants are safe. What was that first one about? Crop circles. Yes, there are crop circles in the world. Some of them are made by Doug and Dave, was it? Those two guys in England who claimed they went all over making them. What's Nancy's name? A woman has done a lot of work on crop circles, has come up with some interesting things. And the fact, sometimes they're made so quickly, you can't figure out how we could have done it. So what their overall significance is, I don't know, because I don't have a really good picture of what's going on. There are crop circles. I've stood in one, as a matter of fact. I didn't feel any special tingling or anything like that. So they're there. Let people who are interested do their studies and publish their results, and we'll take it from there. That's all I can say. The Bermuda Triangle is a region where strange things have happened, as is the rest of the world, a region where strange things have happened. There are a lot of idiots sailing their boats out in the Bermuda Triangle, not allowing for the fact that the weather changes very quickly. And if you're not a really good sailor, you're going to be in trouble. Sorry. You know, unpreparedness is one of the major things of the amateur who takes to the waters. So I don't make a big deal about the Bermuda Triangle. Yes, there have been some ships that have gone down, as there have been in the rest of the world. But when you find out that people are taking a yacht out in the Bermuda Triangle using a shell oil road map of Florida to navigate with, they're asking for trouble. And some of them get it. Did I see a hand over there? Yeah. Well, okay. Yes, people do make the mistake Dr. Hynek used to. He said if the thickness of one playing card represents the distance from the moon to the Earth, then it would take umpteen miles of playing cards to represent the distance to the nearest star. That's thinking linear. Twice as far takes twice as long. Space travel isn't linear. When you go to the moon, if you could double the velocity when you shut off the rocket, you get there 20 times as fast. Because the force going up versus the force coming down, it's the difference that gets you there. The difference. Look, if you're in business to make a profit and you're collecting 60 cents and your costs are, let's say, 40 cents. I've got this confused for a minute, but you get the idea. A small difference in your cost makes a big difference in the profit because it's the difference between the total money and what you're spending. So by watching your P's and Q's, you can increase profit much more than the percentage that you increase either the sales or decrease the cost. It's the difference between the two. So when you're in space, yes, it isn't linear. No, it's just good engineering work, that's all. Look, when the guy who made the calculations, the astronomer who made the calculations of what the initial launch weight of a rocket to the moon would be, he concluded it would be a million tons. We did it with something that weighed 3,000 tons. He made every possible wrong assumption about how we went about doing it. And if you do that, you're going to be in trouble. The engineer makes the right assumption and uses cosmic freeloading. That's my phrase for, you know, when we've got a spacecraft out at Saturn right now, and we sent it past Venus, which is closer to the sun than Saturn, so it would go past the Earth, get a free kick at Venus, get another kick here, get another one at Jupiter, and go up there. Get whatever you can from Mother Nature. All our deep space probes do that. And if you don't, you're going to pay a heck of a price for it. But any smart engineer takes advantage of what's available. I mean, if you got a heavy load, when you're up on the top of a mountain, you'll ski down with or send it down on its own. Somebody's going to come along and say, well, you didn't do that right. Oh, I'll carry it back up and try again. That's kind of silly. You take advantage of Mother Nature. That's why we have launch windows. At certain times, we can get free energy, in quotes, from the planets. The moon does have a gravitational field. Jupiter does kick along your little rocket going by at no cost to you. Be in the right place at the right time. So being clever is much more important than being powerful, muscle-wise. One of Friedman's laws. Yes? I don't know of any correlation between the religions and aliens. I will say this. I heard a great paper by a couple from the University of Delaware. They looked at 11 old civilizations and their stories, and all of them had stories of beings coming down in spacecraft, not gods, crew and craft. And, you know, when all of them, and they found people who spoke the old language and stuff like that. So apparently it's part of our history on this planet that there have been alien visitors. And if you look at artwork from the Middle Ages, what the heck is that saucer doing there in those pictures? I'm not saying they weren't in somebody's imagination, but there's a lot of those pictures, drawings, not photographs, of course. Religion, I recommended earlier, recommend another book, The Bible and Flying Saucers by Dr. Barry Downing. You want an odd combination, Bachelor of Physics and Doctor of Divinity. and that's Barry. And he's a very sharp guy. He's a consultant to MUFON. His problem is he can't get any clergymen to talk to him about this stuff. He goes through the Old and New Testament. They don't want any part of this. The government, who's trying to control how money gets spent on advanced military stuff, benefits considerably from having us not be aware that there are advanced civilizations coming here using advanced technology. People in power want to stay in power. Simple statement, but the basis of much of what goes on this planet. So I think they benefit. And also, they don't have to admit they've been lying all this time. Nobody wants to say, oh, well, we haven't told you the truth for 60 years about this. Or is it 65 now, I guess? But you know, trying to account for why people in government do what they do is not always an easy thing to do, because it doesn't always make sense. But I'm saying they benefit, and maybe companies who get special contracts to do classified work. The black budget gets variously estimated. That's not under direct congressional evaluation. $30 to $40 billion a year. That's a lot of money being dispensed to people, which might go elsewhere if we knew what was going on. I don't speak for the government. You understand that. You may have noticed that I am not pretending to speak for the government. Well, I do know Eric Von Daniken. I like him, as a matter of fact. We've met several times. He's sharper than a lot of his critics are, as a matter of fact. Black holes definitely exist. And how many there are, we don't know. But they're one of many things that we didn't know to be real, say, 100 years ago. The kicker here is we are ignorant. I guess somebody said that in, what's the cartoon? We are ignorant, that kind of thing. What we have come to realize is a heck of a lot that we're just finding out about that somebody more advanced than we are would have known a long time ago. Sorry, that's the way it is. So black holes are real, and there's a lot of them out there. That's interesting. I worry more about supernova. One of those comes around in the neighborhood, and we're dead meat. One of those goes off. Every advanced civilization is going to be looking for a place to stay when the going gets rough, whether it's an asteroid that maybe took care of the dinosaurs. You know, we forget, they were around for, what, 65 million years? How long has man been ruling the roost? A few thousand years? They're more advanced than we are, weren't they? At least they didn't spend their budgets killing each other. Yeah, the dark planet that's going to destroy us all. And there have been stories like this for a very long time. I haven't found anything to support them. And let's face it, there are a lot of guys looking out there. It's a great discovery if you find an extra body in the solar system and stuff like that. And I haven't seen one bit of evidence that there is such a vehicle out there, a planet, planetoid. Now, I will say this. We used to think you could only have planets associated with stars. It turns out there are some planets drifting around, rogue planets. Okay, that's a nice way to put it. So I'm not saying there's nothing that could happen. I'm saying I think we know about it already because it would have disturbed the orbits of the other planets. And we're making a lot of measurements all the time and predicting where things will be and so forth. And there's a lot of astronomers looking. You're going to be looking out tonight, I guess. I don't know. What's the sky like out there tonight? Anybody know? Cloudy? Sorry. Okay, I think that winds it up. Thank you so much for being such a great audience.